Good morning, Paul, my friend. Good morning. Come into the office. Welcome back to my office once again. How are you feeling this week?
Oh, Dr. Heart and Souls, I got your bill.
Oh, yes. I had my assistant mail it out to you last week, yes.
Wow,
yes.
It's a bit more than I was expecting.
Oh, really? It can't be that much of a surprise, surely, Paul.
$84,000?
Well, your case is quite complex. We have had 13 sessions so far, you know. So, you know, as qualified as I am, my services, you know, they do not come cheap.
Right. I might be struggling to pay this. Is there an alternate form of payment that you would accept?
No, Paul, this is quite unexpected. Well, what did you have in mind?
Do you have... Well, you like me, don't you?
What did you have in mind? For?
I'm not sure. There must be something. Something you want that I have.
Let me think on that.
Why are your eyes glowing like that? Oh, that's creepy. Welcome to DC OCD, the DC Events podcast, where we're going through every single DC event from Crisis on Infinite Earths in 1985 all the way up to we're not sure where we'll get to, but come with this journey. And we're going to score them all as we go. And today, we hit the mid-90s, smack dab in the middle of the 90s. So, Mike, what are we talking about today?
Today, Paul, we are talking about Underworld Unleashed, the DC event from 1995. Oh, yeah.
Yes, this one was written by Mark Waid, had art by Howard Porter, Daniel Green, and Dennis Janke. And we're talking about the main book here, lettered by Chris Eliopoulos, and colors by Rick Taylor. And it was all edited by Brian Augustin. So Waid and Augustin sort of working on this one together.
Mm.
So basically, this is superhero Satan comes to the DC universe to tempt people and make the villains more 90s, pretty much.
That's pretty much it, yeah. It was an opportunity for the villains to become more extreme, as everything seemed to be in the 90s, and, you know, yeah, increase their powers and make them even more badass. And, yeah, it was an interesting way of doing it, I guess.
Yeah, so this was a three-issue miniseries. They were slightly oversized, and... there were spin-offs, so there were like four specials that were sort of around this, and something like 25 issues. I'm just guessing. I can't even be bothered.
There was 40 something issues across 30 something titles.
Whoa!
I know, it was everywhere, man. They who wasn't involved? Do you want me to go through them? I've got a list here.
Oh, I've come
prepared.
Wow! Hit me, Mike.
Okay, went through Manhunter, Fate, The Ray, Justice League, Task Force, Starman, Detective Comics, Aquaman, Damage, Flash, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, Guy Gardner Warrior, Extreme Justice, Impulse, it even went into Impulse, Justice League America, Deathstroke, Spectre, Fate, Showcase 95, Superboy, Hawkman, Lobo, Robin, Legion of Superheroes, and the Legionnaires were even involved. So were Rebels 95, Batman, Catwoman, Primal Force, and oddly enough, Superman, Adventures of Superman, and Superman, Man of Tomorrow.
Wow. Basically, this one, it was trying to refresh the villains a bit. So that was the plan of it all. It's a pretty good story. It's well written. It's certainly I dig it. I actually I very much enjoyed giving this a reread. It was lots of fun. How did you find it, Mike? What did you like about it?
I really enjoyed it. I haven't read this in quite some time either, and I've got the collected trade paperback, which also has the one shot Abyss Hell Sentinel, which had the original Green Lantern traveling through hell to rescue his wife from the demons. And I enjoyed that as well. But overall, yeah, it's a great story. It's one of my favorite things about it is that the point of view is mainly that of James Jesse, the trickster. And we sort of see him become, I guess, a lieutenant for Neron. And he's watching all the chaos unfold, and he's kind of keeping his cards close to his chest and ends up actually helping the good guys in the end. Spoiler warning.
Yeah, he's fantastic in this. I mean, just so many nice little bits with him, like the fact at the start where he's conning that pizza boy out of money, but just as the guy's counting back the money to him, he keeps interjecting with numbers.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was cool. I'm still also surprised, even though I've read this before, that the Flash's Rogues Gallery got killed off so quickly in this.
Yeah. I mean, I remember this upsetting people at the time. Like, if you're a big fan of the Flash in the Silver Age, the opener of this may be a bit jarring for you because the main Flash Rogues, like Mirror Master, Boomerang, Captain Cold, Weather Wizard, and there's another one.
The other guy. That one.
Forgotten Man.
Yes.
Yeah, they all get killed. Heatwave, that's who it is.
That was it. Yep.
Yeah. They get contacted to go and do these missions, and they end up making a... they get destroyed in explosions, all of them, from their simple missions, and that creates a massive pentagram on the Earth, which, causes... something, presumably giving superhero Satan, or in this case we call him Neron, access to everybody. And he sends out the creepy black candles and makes an offer. If you light these candles, you know, you can come and make a deal. And he's doing a couple of types of deals, like mostly it's souls. I'd like your soul. And sometimes it's just do this job for me and you can have what you want. And, you know, there's a really good bit where he tricks Blue Devil. He says, you know, you want to be famous and all you got to do is go wipe out this electricity substation. And Blue Devil's like, oh, that, you know, no one's there. That sounds safe. And he goes and destroys the substation. And his longtime friend, Marla, who's his agent, is in a helicopter scouting locations. And the pilot flies into one of the poles in the dark and she dies. And then suddenly he's getting offers for work all over Hollywood. So
yeah, that was actually a really well done scene with Blue Devil as well. As all the calls are coming in, and he's sitting there watching the news report saying that she had just died, and he kind of realizes, oh shit.
Yeah, and you know, lots of bits like that in this book with this jailbreak, and there's all these cause and effect things, like people not being on duty and people being drunk and people being angry and. You know, I love the way this is written and plotted. And I'll go out on a limb right now and say I think this is the best written event we've dealt with so far.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a big call, but I'm picking up the big phone and I'm making, dialing the big numbers on that
you
one.
You sure are, mister. Wow, yeah. Brassy. Take a couple of weeks back and you come back with your big boy pants on. Jeez. Wow. Okay, I'm going to make a big call here as well. Not as big as yours, but I think I like this story so much because it doesn't have Superman involved. I'm not really a fan of Superman at all. I acknowledge his contribution to, the history and the mythos of comics in general and specifically, obviously DC Comics. But this showed that you could do a story without him. And it can be done really well.
Yeah, and his absence actually becomes a plot point because I think he was off in space during having the trial of Superman, which is...
Correct, yes.
Yeah, which is not a good story. Don't bother with that one.
Right, okay.
I would say it's fair that you don't like Superman stories. I would posit an alternate suggestion that perhaps you haven't read many good ones.
Right, okay.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, it's not about educating Mike, it's about dealing with events.
yes. But yeah, I think I enjoyed the fact that, yes, he wasn't there, and yes, it was a plot point as well. But yeah, it was nice to see a big event with, I guess, some other people and characters in the DCU getting some screen time and not Superman. So that was a big thing for me, yeah.
So that, you think that's your big deal for this one? Or?
That is a big deal. It was. I know some people go be up in arms about this, but yeah, it was nice to not have him there for a change. And even like Wonder Woman got a bit more screen time, but even though she and Batman turned up a little bit, they still were kind of in the background as well. You didn't really need the Trinity that much in this one.
Interesting points, Mike. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really like about DC is it had this, you know, there's a lot of supernatural stuff going on in the DC universe for, you know, decades leading up to this. So, you know, you've got the Demon, Jack Kirby's creation. Mm-hmm. He hangs out in hell, and there's other aspects of hell. And when the Sandman series came along, it sort of really consolidated the idea that there's lots of sort of little, you know, there's a bit of Game of Thrones going on in hell, and there's different people in charge.
Yes.
And they're at war. And so it's quite easy to introduce new one and say, hey, this is, you know, there's a demon in hell and he's a bit of a player. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
So, yeah, and Neron, he's, you know, making a big splash. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this series was trying to be a bit of a fixer for the villains, perhaps. Would you say that's what type of event it is? Or?
I guess, yeah, a fixer for some of them. In some ways, it's a launcher in that Neron is still around and being used to this day. Like he showed up in Day of Judgment after this, the 52 series, and he was even apparently in Apollo and Midnighter.
Yeah, I read that. That was great.
Yeah, so it launched Neron for that. So I think it's part launcher, part fixer, as you said. I think it's also part occupy because it's just a cool story to tell, you know, about temptations of power and the costs of obtaining it.
I mean, it starts off, I think, let's refresh the villains and make them all a bit cooler.
Mm.
But then it turns into a bit of a celebration of what's great about the DC Universe already. And, you know, like the villain who has the most influence on solving the problems for, you know, and the most memorable moments of this is James Jesse, and what he gets is basically to be himself, and it sort of builds on, you know, the characterization he got in the Blue Devil series, where he, you know, wasn't entirely villainous, he was, you know, mischievous, and... You know, he likes to play people. He doesn't like to be played. So, you know, that's how he reacts when he meets Neron. So, anyway, yeah, I think this was, I can't think of much that it launched out of it, except for some changes to some villains. And let's be honest, I don't think many of these villainous changes stuck.
No.
Like, they made Killer Moth a monster called Charaxis, which is weird because that's actually a type of butterfly. But it's a badass name. But, you know, eventually they changed him back. But I think the one villain that really got rehabilitated really well is Roland Desmond, the Blockbuster. Because yeah, he was just a hulking dude, and then he got killed, and then they introduced his brother, who was another hulking dude. So, you know, but what came out of this was he got smart. So mm-hmm. And he turned much more into, it's like the body of the Hulk with the mind of the Kingpin, sort of. And they did a hell of a lot with that in Nightwing under Chuck Dixon. And, he, you know, it's a memorable villain, memorable run. And, you know, he made it through to the New 52 and things like that, which, you know, it's good if you can make it into the New 52. Not many people made it out.
Sorry, yes?
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the other changes with the villains, you know, they didn't really need it. I mean, villains routinely, they get re-engineered all the time. Like, people say, I want to use this villain. Okay, what's interesting about them? What's the cool thing about them? And they, you know, I think villains are getting revamps all the time. Yeah. So, and this en masse revamp, it wasn't super effective, but it was a lot of fun. I mean, I have probably about half the tie-in issues for this, and I found, I started reading them, and I found it was like Pringles. I just, I couldn't stop, you know. They're all really fun, and that's not an experience I can say about every event that we've covered on this show.
No. I do have to say that one of my favorite deals done in this is just talking about villains that did or didn't get changed so much. Like the Joker didn't really get changed at all, but I love the fact that the deal he made with Neron was for a box of Cubans. that made me giggle. It was a fun story all around, really. It was really good.
Yeah, I know. In one of the tie-ins, it was funny because Neron keeps showing up and teasing the heroes and saying, oh, I can give you what you want, but he knows they're going to say no, but he said, you know, that's part of his plan because he keeps going, oh, I'm looking for someone, a purer soul than yours, Batman, or you know, or Flash, or whatever.
Yeah.
So he's sort of messing, and they all start to think, oh, he wants Superman. That's, you know, that's the plot point that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
And spoilers for the end of the story, he actually wants Shazam.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool as well.
It was. And the way that, spoiler warnings again, the way that Shazam defeats him is, you know, to unselfishly and, you know, quite willingly offer up his soul to Neron. And Neron's like, oh, wait, what?
Sorry, that reminds me of a friend at school who was one day reading something and he said, what's an unselfish? And I went, unselfish? And he went, ah.
Oh. Oh, my God.
Anyway.
But yeah, and just the fact that, you know, Neron can't sort of really bargain a deal with Shazam, who's so good-natured and so giving, just completely does him in and saves the day, really, which was awesome to see.
Yeah, and there's another story that came probably about 10 months later, where basically the rogues are all in hell and they sort of come back to Earth as like soulless demons, and mm-hmm. Yeah, the Flash has to sort of intervene to get their souls back, and that's another good clash with Neron.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then he showed up in the JLA, and then they did Paradise Lost miniseries.
Yes,
just the demon it wasn't Azrael. I mean, the angel. Zoriel.
Yes, hello. We know what we're talking about when it comes to DC Comics. Yeah, that one, Zoriel. That's him.
Yeah, yeah. And Neron got used again in the JSA. There was quite a good little clash with the Shade in Starman. Yes. Sort of in one of the side issues of Showcase 95, number 12 perhaps, or 10 or something. But in that story, Neron comes to the Shade and says, hey, you want, you know, better powers? And the Shade's like, hey, my powers are awesome already, thanks. and then he says, oh, you'll regret this. And then, you know, that is one of the plot points that comes back later in Starman. So it's good. It's handy for a universe to have a demon that you can use, and making him sort of supernatural but also superheroic. You know, he's got a cape, he's got like a glowing thing on his chest, he's got big shoulder pads.
Yes, and he's not afraid to get physical when he needs to prove a point as well, because, you know, there are quite a few heroes that got smacked the heck around when he was making a point in front of everyone else there. So, you know, Neron can throw down.
Yeah, he really kills Mongol.
Yeah.
And paves the way for Mongol's son to come in and be Mongol.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's a change that's hard to notice, but it did happen.
Right.
Anyway, shall we get into the scoring part of this this gig?
Okay, so as per usual, we're going to kick off with eventiness for our first scoring track. And out of 10, I'm going to give Underworld Unleashed an 8.
Ooh.
Because it's a large-scale tale of temptation, corruption, and dealing with the forces of hell, being led by Neron specifically. Plus, again, for me, the Superman not being present or needed was a bonus. Just quietly. What did you give it for eventiness?
I must have been a bit high on it, because I gave it a 9. So,
ooh, okay.
Yeah. I think I really like the fact that villains were showing up, but they were showing up in different books. So, like, the Shadow Thief showed up in Flash and fought the Flash and Shazam. Impulse got Blockbuster. Batman tended to stick to Batman villains, but there's a really good Mr. Freeze story, and this is sort of where Mr. Freeze got his sort of modern comic look in the comics. So Kelly Jones designed that, and it's awesome. Yeah, but I kind of like that, you know, swap and changing, and, you know, it's good. And I like that, you know, most of the DC universe was involved, and it sort of touched on a lot of things and, you know, a lot of characters.
Yeah.
So I'm giving it 9.
Cool.
As for the writing, well, as I said before, I really love the writing on this. I think this is probably the most delightful read of all the events we've done so far, and it was really breezy to read through it all the way through, the main story particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, getting into the side stories, they were self-contained. A villain shows up, there's something different about the villain, the hero has to work out how to overcome it. Some good designs, excitement, you know, like Gorilla Grodd versus Catwoman, that's fun.
What?
Yeah.
Jeez, I'm missing out there. Gosh.
Yeah, so overall, I really liked it. And, you know, it's probably coloured by the fact that there's some issues I got rid of at some point. Like, I don't have the Jail Justice League-related ones at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't say I've got Primal Force and things like that. But, you know, all the ones I read, I quite enjoyed. So I'm saying it's right up there, and I really love the characterization of the Trickster. So, and there are some really great bits of writing in this where Wade really outdoes himself. So I'm giving it a 9.
Cool. I'm going to give it an 8, and that's I haven't read really any of the tie-ins for it. I know I had the one of the Detective Comics ones way back in the day, but I have somehow lost that issue. So all I've really read of this is the three-part mini itself, and then the Abyss Health Sentinel one-shot. But as you said, it's a solid story. It's a great read. It's an easy read to get through as well. And yeah, another highlight that I really enjoyed in terms of the writing was the fact that the Trickster is our central point of view character for the majority of the story. And that was just, it was a nice change. Not that I don't enjoy, you know, seeing things from the hero side, but it was just cool to, you know, read what was on the villains' minds more so.
Yeah, cool.
Now, for art and covers, I gave it a 7. I don't have a lot of Howard Porter's art, but I was a fan of his stuff when he was doing JLA with Grant Morrison. But I think that came after this series. So I think Underworld Unleashed was like the second thing Porter had done for DC or in his career. So the art's okay for the time it came out. It's very 90s and lots of, you know, standing around and grimacing and that. And, you know, there are some very cool scenes like the breakout of art from, was it Belrive or Arkham? I keep getting them mixed up.
Belrive. There's an Arkham story that's one of the side stories called Devil's Asylum.
That's, Belrive, where all the chaos and that. I quite enjoyed that scene with all the criminals busting out and, you know, going berserk and attacking everything inside. But yeah, overall, it was like, I didn't hate it, but there was nothing that really wowed me. So I think 7's a fair score in terms of art and covers from me. What did you give it, Paul?
I gave it 6. So, okay. Yeah, I'm sort of trying to balance because it is early Howard Porter. He's a little bit, you know, forming into the powerhouse he was to become later. I think I've got to mention the green ink.
Yeah.
Someone bought a shipment of green ink from somewhere and they had to use it up on the main book. And yeah, it's not subtle. It's, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of Ghostbuster Slimer coloured.
Yeah.
And it's all over this book in the cover dress and et cetera and throughout.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's I'm going to include that in the art and use that to mark it down a bit. But, I mean, so there's some good tie-in art. There's some there's Guy Gardner Warrior.
Yeah. So, that's another one I could have done without. But, you know,
yeah. Drawing. I mean, but you've got Jim Ballant, if you like boob.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah, so there's something for everyone if you're heterosexual male particularly. So, yeah, 6 out of 10 for me on that.
Okay.
Yeah, whereas in Legacy, I think, I mean, there's not immediately, oh, this series came out of it and this was a big hit or anything like that. But I think it was a valuable contribution to the DC Universe to get Neron. And as I said,
yes,
they now have this, you know, sort of melodramatic but powerful superhero-like, you know, he's a supervillain version of the devil that you can trot out. And it's, you know, it makes for good stories and it makes for a good character. He can be a schemer in the background or he can be, you know, up front and, you know, posturing. So you've got all types of, you know, capabilities were, and it really wouldn't surprise me if, you know, in the next 5 or 6 years he shows up in the cinemas somewhere, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, he is a natural fit if you're doing some sort of supernatural story, Justice League Dark.
True.
Things like that.
Yep.
You know, who's the bad guy in that? Oh, it could be the devil, you know, but, you know, a palatable cape-wearing devil, not just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think 7 out of 10 for Impact and Legacy. I mean, he's a character that has endured, and, yeah.
Well, yeah, for me, Neron is, like, the big legacy to come out of it because, as we've said, he's shown up time and again, and he can be used again if needed. I gave it a 6, though. I think mostly because it's a great story and it stands up to everything else that we've covered so far in a good way. But, yeah, as you said, there's nothing that really spun out of this with a long-lasting effect other than the creation of Neron. So I gave it 6 for that.
Yeah. Okay. But we don't do this alone. As I mentioned, we have Jimmy McGlinchey from Ireland, and you can detect he's from Ireland from hearing his voice. But, he sent us his semi-OCD score, and let's listen to that now.
Hello, Mike and Paul. Jimmy McGlinchey here. Just like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to become one of your semi-OCD contributors, and today I'm commenting on the storyline Underworld Unleash. Underworld Unleash was the 1995 DC line-wide event, which allowed the creators to pose to the DCU the question that Jack Nicholson so eloquently put, "Did you ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight?" The devil in question in the storyline is Neron, a new demon lord with a silver tongue and an eye for the barter. He could make your wildest dreams come true, but at a price, either your immortal soul or a task that may have unforeseen dire consequences. The event was encompassed in a 3-issue miniseries with 4 tie-ins and crossing over into the majority of the DCU titles in print at that time. My review of the event, as per the norm, is looked at in 4 areas. Number 1, eventiness. For eventiness, I give Underworld Unleashed 8 out of 10. It had a huge scope, tying in not only the heroes of the DCU, but its villains as well. It had been noted that the main impetus of the series was to beef up a number of the supervillains of the DCU, who, in the era when Image was dominating the comics landscape, were considered lame by the 1990s fanboy. It took in the whole breadth of the DCU and even managed to bring in the Legion of Superheroes via the time machinations of Cronus. Even the absence of Superman, who was out in space in his own books during the Superman on Trial storyline, fed into the event by the heroes fearing that Neron had captured Superman, thus leading to the final assault on Neron's turf. The event had an epic feel to it, thus resulting in my high score. Writing. The writing is a tricky one for me. If I was considering the miniseries on its own, the writing would get 10 out of 10. This was Mark Waid at the height of his DCU career, the writer who brought Wally West out of the doldrums and into the upper echelon of the DCU pantheon of heroes. His writing and plotting was excellent. He created a compelling villain in Neron, a demon who would prefer to persuade you to do the wrong thing, but had the muscle to force his viewpoint if needed, as witnessed by Mongol and by Kyle Rayner during the miniseries. In developing James Jesse the Trickster as our point of view character, he successfully shows that you don't need an increase in powers to bring new life into a tired character. And his development of the plot is just as good. The chain of events described in issue 1 that brought about the prison break in Bel Rev was sublime. Finally, the most evocative piece of writing came in issue 2 when Neron tried to tempt Batman with the resurrection of Jason Todd. And as Batman refused and Neron walked away with the spirit of Jason, Batman tries to run after him and the captions read thusly. The footsteps begin again, but they don't stop. They shuffle back into the darkness, and just when he thinks they are gone, they're replaced by the echo of an iron bar caving in what sounds not quite a pumpkin. The force of these words with the art of Batman kneeling on the floor of the Batcave gives me chills every time I read it. However, we have to look at the writing of the event overall, and I feel that the tie-ins bring down the overall score a bit. Apart from Devil's Asylum, expertly set out by Alan Grant, the other main tie-ins were quite poor. The individual tie-ins give some filling to the items that were only mentioned in the main story, but they do tend to follow the pattern of supervillain has new powers and attacks superhero. Where DC writers did well, though, was to mix up the regular villain versus hero battles so that you saw something new, like Shadow Thief versus Flash or Mr. Freeze versus Green Lantern. On the whole, Wade's efforts outweigh the minor drops from the other issues, and I give the writing an 8 out of 10. 3. Art. The art in the main series was handled by Howard Porter. This was his second major assignment after handling the Adventures of the Ray. As such, his style is still developing, and I don't think we've seen the best of him like we did subsequently in JLA or The Flash. His characters tend to be very stiff, and there is no fluidity in the action scenes. Characters look like they are frozen in time rather than in movement. However, there are hints in the series as how his art will develop going forward, and in some instances, like the scene of Batman kneeling in my earlier description, or Blue Devil sitting in his chair listening to the film industry offering him jobs in the wake of his agent's death, the art really complements the writing. In addition, the increased use of green in the color art gives it a distinct style which suits the art. As with the writing of the main four main tie-in books, only Devil's Asylum with Brian Stelfreeze's art holds up well art-wise. Hell Sentinel had early Phil Jimenez art, which generally looks too overcrowded and busy for my taste, while the art in Patterns of Fear looks very poor indeed. Overall, I would give the art 6 out of 10. Impact and Legacy. No new titles came out of the Underworld Unleashed series, which was surprising enough. Indeed, in looking at the tie-ins, this was the end or near the end for a number of titles, with Manhunter, Fate, Justice League Task Force, Warrior, Extreme Justice, Damage, Primal Force, Rebels, and Justice League America all finishing up their runs either at the crossover or within 6 to 8 months. We just have to look at the impact on the various characters shown highlighted in the series. Neron. The main benefit was that DCU had a supernatural evil character which they could use across the board. He showed up a year later in Flash when he was used to bring back the 5 dead rogues who were killed at the start of the miniseries back to torment the Flash. Subsequently, he came up on a regular basis, being involved in the debut of Zor-El in Morrison's JLA run and turning up in a future DC event, Day of Judgment, by Geoff Johns. His last major appearance was in Reign in Hell, a miniseries where he battles against Blaze and Satanas, two other supernatural characters from Hell. The Trickster. Probably the most fascinating character in the miniseries, there was potential for him developed into someone like Catwoman, a villain who skirts both sides of the law, but he was rarely used thereafter and just became part of the FBI in Geoff Johns' run on The Flash before eventually turning back to becoming a rogue by the top during the Rogue War. Supervillains. For the most part, the supervillains who were amped by Neron did not have any lasting power. Mark Waid himself lamented that he killed the 5 rogues at the start of the story and was soon trying to resurrect them again in the Flash series. The main character arising that was amped up by Neron and the main character that had most staying power was Blockbuster, who was given enormous intellect to complement his great strength, and Chuck Dixon used them extremely well as the foil to Nightwing in his series. Major Disaster was another character who came out well from this and was used in the subsequent Neron story in The Flash before eventually becoming a superhero himself many years later in Joe Kelly's JLA run. Lex Luthor was also brought back to vitality by Neron after being left a husk in the Fall of Metropolis storyline in the Superman titles, but that hardly counts because, come on, he's Lex Luthor, of course he was going to come back. The Tempted Superheroes. They had some good storylines that followed on after the miniseries. Triumph, the Justice League's Task Force member who was an anomaly created by Zero Hour, had his candle lit accidentally, which gave him back the decade he lost. Kid Devil, Blue Devil's sidekick, received a candle as well and used that to gain superpowers. Finally, Blue Devil himself became more than a man stuck in a suit and was actually converted into a devil. His story was subsequently developed further in the Day of Judgment and the Shadow Pack series. Overall, the impact of the storyline was quite good, and we give that a 6 out of 10. This gives me a final score of 28 out of 10, which, because I'm semi-OCD, gives you a score of 14 to add to your scores.
So, 14. Thanks, Jimmy. Wow, that's a good score.
Jimmy.
Yeah, 14 out of 20. Ooh. So, we have the scores, so I can add together. Mike, you gave it 29 out of 40. I gave it 31 out of 40. So, mm-hmm. Add those together. That gives us 60, and then we add Jimmy's 14. Because we've halved it, so from 28, and that gets us 74 out of 100, which is a pretty respectable score. So.
That is. That puts it just between Wonder Woman the Contest and Eclipso.
Wow.
So,
okay.
That's respectable. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's fair to say we would both recommend this one if you want to go and check it out for yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
I mean, I think it's on Comixology. You can probably find the trade still around.
Yeah.
But it's a fun one. I mean, I kind of wished DC would do a big collection of this and collect lots of the side stories because it's, you know, it'd make it a pretty good omnibus and it would be very self-contained.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice to see, actually, for those of us that haven't read them all yet. But anyway, yeah, sure.
Well, we have a little bit of feedback. So Dr. Ange wrote to us about Zero Hour way back. And he said, Great show, guys. I'll say that this one is a tough one for me to judge. I can't tell you anything concrete that happens in the main mini outside of Damage, whose book I liked, him playing a surprisingly big part for someone so new. But I don't go back and reread Zero Hour the way I reread Crisis, Legends, or even Final Crisis. Yeah, that's true. That said, I bought into the concept of Zero Month, buying a ton of the Zero issues to sample titles, even nutty ones like Manhunter and Primal Force. But I wasn't reading the Wade Flash until Zero Month. Jurgens used the Superman Zeros to look back at young Clark and introduce Conduit. Who can forget Conduit? Oh, sorry, editorializing. So for me, this is a launcher. I sampled a lot of DC books, and as Doug said, I buy the Zero issues whenever I see them in the bargain box. Still, can we call it a success if I don't remember the main book at all? Perhaps my pro-Hawk stance has blocked out all post-Armageddon versions.
Ooh.
Fair points, Ange. Fair points.
Thanks, Ange.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's it for this time. So if you want to get in touch with us, like Dr. Ange, you can send us an email at dcocdcast@gmail.com. As always, we're on Twitter at dcocdcast. Mike, where are you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter at avantgarve.
Yep, and I'm on Twitter at reading_hicks, H-I-X. And that's all. So next time, if you want to join us, we'll be doing a long-awaited Waiting for Doom, where the TV news is starting to hot up, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes. Sorry. I had to think, what TV are you talking about? Then I realized you meant the show. Yes. Agreed. Yes. It's all happening. It's all getting very exciting. Yes.
Yeah. But we'll be back after that with another DCOCD, and we are doing, oh, please don't pick on us for this one, Kingdom Come. So still copping it for Cosmic Odyssey, but we're going to do Kingdom Come because, you know, yeah, well, it's our show.
Right.
It's our show.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Paul. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Catch you all next time. Bye.
Bye.